On April 19, 1951, during the Korean War, General Douglas MacArthur gave a farewell address to Congress.
But once war is forced upon us, there is no other alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision.
MacArthur had just been relieved of his command because of fears his strategy would lead to an all-out war with China and the Soviet Union.
In war, there is no substitute for victory.
MacArthur was set on victory. But unlike previous American conflicts, the strategy it was felt in Korea needed to be limited, meaning no clear end in sight. And that changed the way our country forevermore handled its war dead. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later in the show, an approach to the daunting process of benefits claims for veterans.
As a veteran, why am I still fighting a war on American soil for something that is rightfully mine?
But first, a new course dreamed up by students at the College of William & Mary called Veterans Comedy Boot Camp is bringing laughter and storytelling to a classroom designed just for vets. Lilia Fukin has more.
People are always asking me, do you guys get that little Puerto Rican flag to hang in your car when you get your driver's license? Like, that's such a horrible stereotype. I mean, I don't have a flag hanging in my rear view mirror. Come on. Minus on a sticker on the back. Thank you.
That's Isauda Ramirez, a graduate of the nation's first Veterans Comedy Boot Camp, where vets study stand-up with professional comedians. Isauda's a decorated combat veteran deployed 15 months in Iraq with 10 years of military service. She now runs a Zoyo frozen yogurt shop, and she also struggles with depression.
I was actually hospitalized for depression and suicidal ideation. So I have a lot of anger that's been accumulated. So this really relaxes me, you know, and you know, I got to make friends and just laugh every week, which I don't get to do a lot. It's helped me so much.
Comedy comes naturally to Isauda, whose husband found the course and signed her up for it. William & Mary student Ryan Goss co-founded the comedy boot camp.
Her husband actually reached out on her behalf and said, "This is perfect for my wife. I have been waiting for years to try to get her into a program like this. Like, this is, you know, a godsend," he said.
It was so much fun. I mean, I don't know how a normal class would go with civilian people, but military, I think everybody just got along so well.
Veterans Comedy Boot Camp is a program of the Center for Veterans Engagement, which is the brainchild of William & Mary Sr. Sam Pressler. The center also offers writing and music programs. Sam was inspired to create the center by two things: the Veterans Administration's report that 22 veterans commit suicide each day, and the 2007 debacle with abysmal service by the VA. Co-founder Ryan says this course is offered at no cost to veterans.
It is absolutely free. Part of the heart of this whole idea of the Center for Veterans Engagement is taking care of our vets when they come back stateside, when there are so many resources that fail them.
Henry Ramey is another graduate of Veterans Comedy Boot Camp.
I'm Henry, H-E-N-R-Y, Ramey, R-A-M-E-Y. Excuse my southern accent, I talk slow.
Henry began his military career at Fort Benning.
I went in as a medic because I wanted to be a doctor. And that never happened. So I ended up in the artillery and came out as a major.
Henry says the sense of camaraderie in the class can be therapeutic.
I guess you can somewhat bare your soul that you've been through some of the trials or just some of the misadventures. And that, you know, I think is a moment of sharing, which other people can feel relieved that, hey, I wasn't the only one that went through this.
Henry says that stand-up comedy is a vehicle of self-expression that's enriched his poetry and short story writing.
You either had to be funny or not funny, you know, NF or F. So it was the first class that I had shot for an F in.
While Henry plans to focus on his writing, Isaura has her sights set on joining the USO tour.
Like, I just recently discovered that I have an accent. And it's especially embarrassing because I always thought I sounded like Christina Aguilera when I sang in the shower. But I probably sound more like J-Lo at a live concert.
For With Good Reason, I'm Lilia Fukin.
In recent years, news stories have mounted over the delays U.S. military veterans face when making benefits claims through the Department of Veterans Affairs. The VA was even sued recently by a public advocacy group after some veterans claimed they'd waited more than 2 years for necessary documents. With Good Reason producer Kelly Libby reports on an organization that's helping veterans and their families get their benefits much faster.
Althea Williams has spent more than 15 years trying to get VA compensation on behalf of her uncle, Richard Judkins, a World War II Navy veteran who died in 2001. You can hear the frustration in her voice.
The reason I'm here today to talk, so maybe we can help some other families that the loved one going through this year, and they stop sweeping stuff underneath the rug, because these people are human, they're World War II, and they do not need to be treated like that.
According to Williams, the way her uncle was treated is this. Before he died, he was living at a VA medical center where his ill-fitting wheelchair caused sores on his leg. Doctors at a VA hospital did an amputation, but they removed the wrong leg. So Judkins ended up having to lose both his legs.
And he just suffered for to be a veteran, a World War II veteran.
Judkins appealed for disability compensation for the loss of his leg, but was repeatedly denied.
And next thing I know that he was dead. You know, they say he died from heart congestion.
And because Williams was not a spouse or child of Judkins, she now has no legal grounds to receive compensation on behalf of her deceased uncle. But there may be some hope for justice. Williams is one of about 70 clients being served by an innovative program at the William & Mary Law School. The Lewis B. Puller Jr. Veterans Benefits Clinic pairs clients like Williams with law students and professors who work on their cases for free. Patty Roberts is a clinical professor of law and the director of the Puller Clinic, where she works one-on-one with veterans.
They're angry, they're depressed, they're frustrated. And as you've been reading, these aren't delays like you might get your decision in 9 months instead of six. I mean, these are delays of years and years, where people are desperate sometimes for benefits.
Roberts says that part of the problem with the delays is that veterans have to face the process on their own at first. That's where the law students come in.
Whether it's social media searches to try to find some former unit members so they can get a lay statement, or going through thousands of pages of deck logs for a ship, there are lots of ways that we go about developing a case that I think exceed what a private practitioner might be able to do, and certainly what a veteran might be able to do on their own.
On their own, the process can take years for a veteran, sometimes with no results. Bill Burke is one of the law students who works at the clinic. He's also a veteran who himself had the experience of navigating the disability claims process.
You know, I was an officer, I had a master's degree, I should have been able to understand it, and the thought of a 19-year-old who may have traumatic brain injury or PTSD going through it really unsettled me, and it really attracted me to put this legal education to service for filling that gap, I guess, so that people with those thornier cases could get some help.
We don't know how to write the Nix's letter, or we don't know how to write the notice of disagreement. We don't know the appeal process.
Kevin Carr served in the Navy for 20 years. He's now a client at the Puller Clinic.
As a veteran, why am I still fighting a war on American soil for something that is rightfully mine?
As part of his claims process, Carr is being evaluated for post-traumatic stress disorder.
I want to know, do I have PTSD? I wanted to know if I had that, because I was getting irritable, and I didn't know what was causing it. So you want to prepare your family and let them know, okay, this is why.
Roberts says that for an average PTSD or traumatic brain injury case, the clinic estimates that annually they're providing nearly $500,000 in free legal services. But what they also provide for clients is simply a sense that someone's on their side. Althea Williams, who continues to fight for answers about the disability and death of her uncle, is no longer doing it on her own.
And I'm glad that somebody took some time to really sit down and go over some the paperwork and stuff with me, and knowing that I was fighting to try to get some justice out of this.
Aniela Szymanski is a staff attorney who's taken on her case. Szymanski says her hope is that even if Williams can't stand in her uncle's place legally, at least his story can gain the attention of those in power.
And if a change can be made in the law to make sure that negligence or incompetence is in some way acknowledged, corrected, and not just ignored because someone doesn't happen to have a spouse or a child that survives them, then I feel like that would be a great success for her and for Mr. Judkins.
Virginia Senator Mark Warner has touted the Puller Clinic as a model for addressing the nation's backlog of claims. For With Good Reason, I'm Kelly Libby.
You're listening to With Good Reason. Coming up, bringing home our soldiers killed in battle. Before the Korean War, the bodies of American soldiers killed in conflicts abroad were buried in overseas cemeteries, but the nature of the conflict in Korea changed that. Brad Coleman is a professor of history at Virginia Military Institute and director of the John A. Adams Center for Military History and Strategic Analysis at VMI. He says the Korean War also brought about the development of forensic anthropology. Brad, before the Korean War, what was done with the bodies of American soldiers?
American dead were often placed in military cemeteries at or around the battlefield. Occasionally, families would make efforts to recover the remains of their loved ones and to bring them back to their hometowns. That was very expensive and typically only involved the families of officers.
So what about the 20th century when we began to fight abroad? Did that shock us that we needed to change the way we handled the war dead?
Right. So the first major overseas experience we have in that context is the Spanish-American War in 1898. And the U.S. government made the decision to bring all of the bodies back to the United States. They're all in Arlington National Cemetery today. The U.S. involvement in World War I, the Great War in Europe, actually set off a pretty significant national debate how to best honor the dead. There were some that sincerely believed that American military dead should remain overseas on the hollow ground on which they fell. Other families wanted the bodies back. So the U.S. government made a uniquely democratic decision and decided to empower the next of kin to determine the disposition of the remains. So if a family wanted the bodies back in the United States, the U.S. government shipped them back after the conflict. If the families wanted the bodies to remain in Europe, the United States established a series of military cemeteries in Europe to house those remains.
During the Korean War, we became much more expert at actually identifying the bodies of the war dead. Was that a problem in World War I?
It's a problem historically. 100%, nearly 100% of American military dead during the Mexican-American War were unidentified. During the American Civil War, Confederate and Union soldiers recognized the enormous problem of identification, and they actually began marking their uniforms during battle to preserve their identity in death.
How would they do that?
They would typically do that by writing their name on a piece of paper and pinning it to their uniform during combat. Now, during the Spanish-American War, an American chaplain in the Philippines came up with the idea of an identification medallion. That is a disc that they would wear around their neck to preserve their identity in death. That becomes a standard U.S. Army issue in 1913, right before World War I, and that is the dog tag, which American service members are required to wear.
Huh. So that should have solved all of our problem after that. Once you have dog tags, you're done.
Well, it's circumstantial evidence. And of course, there are a lot of complications. I mean, battle wounds are such that often dog tags are disassociated with the body as a result of artillery fire and or small arms fire. Some soldiers prefer not to wear them. That is, they think they're bad luck, that if you wear them, they would actually increase the likelihood or chance of getting killed. And then typically, this was especially a problem in Korea during the first months, enemy forces, opposing forces, would often remove dog tags from remains as souvenirs and or as evidence of their having defeated a U.S. military unit. So they would collect them for propaganda purposes.
What was different between World War II and Korea in terms of how we handled our war dead?
By World War II, we have a lot of the pieces in place. But because it is a global total conflict, the U.S. military cannot ship remains back during combat operations. They had never done that before, and they did not do that in World War II. So what they do instead is have these specialized units that are responsible for caring for the dead, and they create a series of overseas cemeteries, these temporary cemeteries at or around battlefields, and they're all over the planet. After the conflict, they go through the identification process that is confirming the identity of the dead and determining the desires of the next of kin. Those families during World War II that want their loved ones' remains to stay overseas, the military ends up creating a series of huge overseas cemeteries. This is Normandy, the Punch Bowl in Hawaii, and other places. The recovery and identification process for World War II is ongoing when the Korean War starts. So in 1950, they're still searching the planet for American dead.
What was different about Korea that allowed the United States to send war dead back to the United States more quickly?
Korea represented a departure for the United States in its approach to war. Korea was a limited war. It was a limited conflict with limited goals and objectives. Korea is the first time that we repatriated our remains while combat operations were ongoing, and we have repeated that in every conflict since. Why? I think one key political piece of this is that in the past, while they were waging total war to achieve a total victory, they could ask the American public to wait for the remains. But since they were not using all the instruments of American power to achieve a total decisive victory, it was difficult for them to ask the families to wait for an indefinite period of time to return the remains of their loved ones.
Was the idea of waging a limited war in this way in Korea confusing for Americans or controversial?
It was exceptionally controversial, and it was exceptionally confusing. Here's a letter from a mother, actually a telegram from Madeline Smith in Tucson, Arizona, to President Harry S. Truman, in which she writes that my only son is dead in Korea, shot down by forces aided by our so-called indispensable enemies. It is murder to send our boys to fight with their hands tied by your limited police action. You are throwing away the United States. Have you forgotten how Americans fight? Don't you realize your responsibility to many bitter, resentful mothers?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. When the war begins, public opinion is 60. I think the Gallup poll during the summer of 1950, when Americans intervened to defend South Korea, public opinion ran something 66% in favor of U.S. military intervention. By the spring, less than 35% of Americans support the war in Korea.
How bad was the Korean War in terms of war dead?
There were roughly 36,000 American dead in Korea compared to slightly over 400,000 during World War II. And Korea really becomes the foil for the good war during World War II. And this is a letter from a woman in New Jersey whose son is missing in action still in 1954. She writes to President Truman. On November 28, 1950, my son was declared missing in action. My son, who spent the prime of his life in war, fighting and killing to preserve the American way of life. Had I lost him in World War II, I would have given him up proudly, but the Korean War was, to me and many other American people, a war provoked by stupid, selfish individuals only to slaughter thousands of healthy American young boys. her son had fought in Europe during World War II. And she, of course, here is saying that had he died in World War II, it would have been okay. But Korea was a waste. I think it's interesting, and this is perhaps a reflection of the sentiment of the families. During World War II, the next of kin had a choice to leave their remains in overseas cemeteries or bring them back. During World War II, 40% of the families chose to leave their families in overseas cemeteries. And these are the spectacular cemeteries in places like Normandy, France. Korea, none. Not a single family chose to leave their family in Korea.
So why none?
I think that reflects the gross unpopularity of the conflict, certainly among the families of the dead.
So there were other changes also that were more forensic about how we handled the war dead in Korea. Anthropologists begin to play a role in how we identify the war dead.
Yes. In 1946, the Army invites a prominent physical anthropologist to go to Europe to look at the identification processes that are underway to identify American dead in Europe. That is Harry Shapiro. He was at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And Shapiro makes a series of recommendations for the creation of these identification laboratories across the planet to help the military assure the proper identification of the dead. Now, a key breakthrough occurs at one of these laboratories in Hawaii. There is a Washington University anatomist, Dr. Mildred Trotter, who is working on the identification of dead in a laboratory in Hawaii. And she raises the possibility of having physical anthropologists conduct research using the data that they were collecting for the identification of the dead.
So we allow our war dead in Korea to be the subject of forensic anthropologists so they can learn more about human remains? I'm not sure that sounds like a good idea, that it's respectful enough.
Yeah, and that was I think, the concern of the Army. But ultimately, they made a compelling case that it was important to advance the science and that by advancing the science, they were ultimately serving the national interest.
In what way? What might be the ultimate good?
By conducting research in the laboratory, as they were identifying the dead, they could produce a series of studies that would improve the science and assure the proper identification of American dead in future conflicts.
Do you think that happened?
It does, absolutely, yeah. So the Korean War comes to a negotiated settlement in 1953. The two sides agree to swap war dead. So the U.S. would collect, recover, and then return Chinese and North Korean dead. And Chinese and North Korean forces would go around North Korea and collect all the dead of all the Americans and others that they could find and ship them to South Korea. So there was a huge transfer of American dead to the identification laboratory in 1954. And that presented the most unique opportunity for academic physical anthropologists to conduct research that would ultimately produce the field of forensic anthropology.
And where were those labs? That was in Japan?
Right. The lab was in Kokura, Japan. So when the Communist Chinese intervene in November and December of 1950, and they're pushing the U.S.-led United Nations Army down the Korean Peninsula, it is the assumption of military officials that we're not going back to North Korea. And so they start evacuating American military dead out of the cemeteries. And this is the first time in American military history where we've evacuated dead in the face of an advancing army.
They had been buried in the
cemetery? They had been buried. So they are working frantically to try and disinter all the remains that had been buried in these temporary cemeteries. They were, again, following a World War II model. So they're frantically disinterring all these remains and trying to preserve them and keep them from falling into enemy hands. So they set the lab up in Kokura, Japan, because they thought it was a safe distance away from the Korean Peninsula. The United States military enters into a relationship with a series of prominent physical anthropologists to conduct very broad studies with those human remains. Now, the field of physical anthropology was wholly dependent on a series of studies with very limited populations.
What you're saying is before this, there weren't very many bodies for forensic anthropologists to study.
Right, and those bodies weren't especially healthy. So, for instance, they're doing studies that depend on data generated from unclaimed bodies at morgues in Europe. And that simply is not the same population that's fighting in the United States military in Korea. So T.L. Stewart is at the Smithsonian, and he leads this project. And they determined that by looking at certain elements of the skeleton, the ossification of bones, for instance, the length and dimensions of certain bones, that they can make very accurate predictions. The sex, the age of the remains, as well as the stature of the remains, that is height. So none of this is possible unless you have good medical records for American service members before they die, because you need that data set, dental records, height, weight, stature, hair color, for instance, tattoos, other markings. You need that information to assure the proper identification of the dead. So part of this is uniquely American in that we have an exceptionally advanced medical system, and we did during the 1950s and before, for American service members. The identification of the dead is utterly dependent on good medical records for the living.
Where are we now in terms of how we handle our war dead in Afghanistan, Iraq, and these other arenas?
You know, we are light years ahead. Stewart's study was only one of about a dozen that the U.S. Army supported during the Korean War. And those studies attracted attention and resources to the field of physical anthropology and the forensic sciences very broadly. The development of DNA technologies during the late 1970s and early 1980s, of course, add another layer of authenticity to this process. In Korea, from the moment a service member died on the battlefield until they were returned to their family, typically that was a 30-day window. And that was without precedent in American history. Today in Afghanistan or Iraq, remains are typically back with the family within 72 hours. And a huge part of that is the care and attention that the United States military gives to the identification and repatriation of the remains. And it is also, I think, part of the enduring legacy of the investment that the Army makes in the science during the war in Korea.
Brad Coleman, this is fascinating. Thank you for sharing your insights on this with me on With Good Reason.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad at last there's peace in Korea. Yes, I'm so glad at last there's peace in Korea. Don't you know, I'm so glad at last there's peace in Korea. Because President Eisenhower has done just what he said.
Brad Coleman is a professor of history at Virginia Military Institute and director of the John A. Adams Center for Military History and Strategic Analysis.
Hope we'll have happiness.
This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. In November, more than 50 years ago, John F. Kennedy was laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery.
The small grave markers bearing testimony to other heroes lying in rest here.
Arlington is perhaps our nation's most hallowed ground. Those 624 acres directly across the Potomac River from the Lincoln Memorial honor those who served our nation. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason.
Beside Mr. Kennedy's grave here in Arlington will be an eternal flame, which is never.
With its rolling green hills and nearly 400,000 graves, Arlington National Cemetery is one of the nation's most impressive military tributes. This is a rerun of an interview we did about collaboration between the Library of Congress and the students and faculty at George Mason University, who spent a month observing the inner workings of Arlington Cemetery. Deborah Latanzi-Shutica is director of folklore at George Mason University. She led the project. She joined me along with her graduate student, Carrie Kaliba. There was a scandal at Arlington not long ago about records at the cemetery.
Yes. The major one was a failure to modernize. They had records of every burial on small index cards that they kept in a very large cardex in the basement of the visitor center. And when they wanted to know where someone's grave was located, they would look this up on the cardex and give it to the guest. and it would have some coordinates, but they wouldn't know exactly where a loved one might be located. So what happened was is that after 9/11 and the wars in the Middle East, then you had the death of a lot of World War II era veterans. They had an abundance of people who were requesting internment at Arlington, and people made mistakes. They were discovering that remains were mislocated and that they couldn't account for the location of veterans who had been interned there.
Has there been a change? What happened? A new management team came in.
Absolutely. In the past, the cemetery was run by civilians, and at this point, it's run by the Army, basically bringing the cemetery into the digital age. And part of that was going out and geolocating every single gravesite in the cemetery. And if you were to go to the App Store, you could basically download an app for Arlington National Cemetery. If you have a name of a friend or a loved one, you can basically type it in there, and it will tell you exactly where the headstone is located. And if you're in the cemetery, it will provide directions so you can walk right up to it.
That's such a fabulous service. Carrie, what part of the operation were you studying?
I was with the operations office, which is all the ceremonies and events that are not funerals.
And are there a lot of this?
Every single day, more than one. It's all of the heads of state and foreign dignitaries coming to do a wreath laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. It's all of the school groups and independent groups who want to come and lay a wreath at the tomb. Memorial Day was my first day in the field with President Obama and the First Lady. We went to a memorial service for Medgar Evers that was hosted by the NAACP with former President Bill Clinton as the keynote speaker. So there are always events going on.
I think for most of us across the country who were baby boomers, our understanding of Arlington Cemetery came with the death of President Kennedy and the eternal flame at his gravesite in Arlington.
President Kennedy's birthday occurred while I was assigned to the field school, so we went to the Kennedy birthday wreath laying, and it was very much that moment of understanding how far we've come since the 60s. It is this very formal, very military thing. With the honor guard and the color guard, we have the bugler playing taps, we have the resident general for the Military District of Washington laying the wreath. But there's a moment when I was watching this event and realized that the area around the grave was completely filled with mostly school groups in their tie-dyed t-shirts and shorts. And for the 15 minutes of the ceremony, it was completely silent, and the only thing you can hear is the bugler. And then within 15 minutes of the end of the ceremony, it was just this wave of noise as people suddenly were allowed to talk to each other and chatter and pull out their cameras and take a picture of the flame and take pictures of the views, until finally at least one employee had to remind the group that this was a place of respect and silence, and we needed to keep it down.
On an average day in Arlington, they're having between 27 and 30 funerals. And what's amazing is families have complete privacy. So you don't have to worry about a tour group stumbling onto a private funeral. And that, to me, is the amazing thing that they have done in Arlington with the modernizing process. They have a computer program that everyone looks at. They know exactly what's going to be happening as far as wreath layings and other events, so that one funeral will never encounter another, and that no funeral will ever encounter a tour group or a wreath laying ceremony or another memorial.
That's important, right?
Absolutely. This is often the last contact that a military family will have with the Army. And so you can only get that right one time.
Step back for a moment and tell me about Arlington Cemetery, what it looks like and what makes it unique in our country.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's an open space that covers just about a square mile. The landscape is perfectly manicured and well-maintained. When you look out across the landscape, what you see are rows of tombstones that are perfectly aligned to kind of emulate lines of soldiers marching in unison along those rolling hills. It's quite spectacular.
The stones are perfectly uniform white squares. and all of the names are the same font. You know, you have your name, you have your rank, you have where you serve, and any other personal information that the family wishes to have on the stone. It's incredibly peaceful and wonderfully uniform to have these rolling green hills and fields that are just perfectly marked out by these white stones.
How beautiful to have them all be the same, as though in death we are all one.
Yes, that was one of the beautiful sentiments that I heard at many ceremonies, was that race and color and creed and all of these other boundaries are erased in this moment, and everyone is brothers and sisters in arms equally.
It's actually quite beautiful to see the symmetry, particularly on Memorial Day. The soldiers from Fort Myer come over and they put a flag on every single stone, so that when you walk through the cemetery, not only are the headstones the same, but you see a small flag on every gravesite. When my father and my uncles, everyone grew up, the expectation was is that at some point they would serve the nation through the military. But that's not the case anymore. At Arlington, it's the one place where we can reflect on the role of service and sacrifice in American life.
Carrie, did you have family members who were also in the military?
I do. My father was in the Navy. My grandfather served in World War II, and my great-grandfather served in World War I.
You know, my husband's father died recently, and Marines came with a flag that they folded with exquisite precision and presented with great solemnity and flair to my husband and his family. It is the one time, I guess, when so many of us experience this very moving side of our military.
Indeed. And I think for most of the students who participated in the field school, it gave them some insights, not only to the idea of service and sacrifice, but the vast military traditions that are carried out at Arlington. Most of them saw many full honors military funerals where the caskets were drawn in a horse-drawn caisson with the full military band, a 21-gun salute. In some cases, with the Air Force, they would have flyovers in honor of the deceased.
The caissons are so striking because they're so formal. They're these gorgeous, huge horse-drawn carriages, the sorts of things that you've only ever seen really in movies before because they're so elaborate. And one of the things that I noticed very much was that it was an ongoing thing. It wasn't just, here's the funeral and that's it. There is perpetual care. The graves are so well tended, and you know the grounds are being very well taken care of. And I think the only place in the world I can think of where you can see so much national history encapsulated in one spot. The Kennedy grave and all that that entails, but also the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And just across the way from there is the marker for the Challenger explosion. And it's this very small geographic area that has some of the biggest events in our history. And because it's next to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and the Memorial Amphitheater, it's remarkable to have so much in front of you.
Deborah Latanzi Shudica is director of folklore at George Mason University. Her graduate student is Carrie Kaliba, who participated in the Field School for Cultural Documentation. Their interviews with cemetery workers are archived at the Library of Congress. There are countless books on caring for our favorite trees, but my next guest says some of our standard practices are doing more harm than good. Joe Murray is a professor of biology and a boriculture program director at Blue Ridge Community College. He's here to talk about some of the misconceptions we have about caring for our favorite trees. Joe, you have been really startling audiences that include even master gardeners with the news that too many of us, in the process of trying to give extra care to special trees in our yards or on or around important buildings, are actually hurting them.
Yes, I suppose sometimes they learn this from do-it-yourself websites and television shows. For example, I watched one television show. It's nationally syndicated. It was a 5-minute presentation on pruning, and the individual made 10 statements on pruning, 5 of which were factually incorrect.
I can see somebody like me, I am not a gardener, ruining a tree that I really care about. I cannot see people very skilled in yard maintenance and gardening making that same mistake.
No, it happens to master gardeners and professionals as well. If you carry the body of knowledge that you had in the 80s or the 90s, a lot of that's incorrect. Arboriculture, the art and science of taking care of trees, is a very young industry, and it's a very young scientific discipline as well.
You're an arborist, right?
Yes.
Did you have sort of trial by fire in your own career?
Oh, absolutely. When I would be spraying insecticides, I took care of all the insects, but I also took care of beneficial insects as well. That's why a secondary pest, the mites, moved in and took over, and I had to go back to all those properties and now spray a miticide. I also noticed, too, when I would fertilize, we were pretty cavalier with how we used to fertilize in the past, and now we know that if a tree receives nitrogen and it didn't need it, it is more likely to experience drought stress. And the reason why is the shoot system grows, but the root system does not. And also, insects really are desirous of nitrogen, and they can see that in a tree. When the tree has been fertilized and it doesn't need to, it continues to grow into the summer when it really should be in a defensive posture. So we know these things now based upon research.
What did you used to say to people, and what do you say now?
Well, our industry standards used to be that you could prune up to 33% of the foliage off of a tree at one time. And now what we're telling folks is have a specific objective and just prune to that objective. Maybe you only take off 10% of the foliage. Fine, you're done.
What are some of the other things that gardeners have become used to doing with their trees that you've discovered are not a great idea?
Oh, many. Planting, for one. Most of the time should be spent in picking the right tree for a particular site. Too many times people are planting with aesthetics in mind, for example, but it's very important to match the tree to the site. If you don't, then you do have to rely more on those environmental subsidies like pesticides and fertilizer and things like that.
How much does grass and lawn care compete with tree development?
It's not a compatible plant with trees. They've been apart for over 200 million years, and in the U.S., we brought them right back together and put one on top of the other. Grass is much better at a competition than tree roots are. So when tree roots and grass are growing in the same space, the tree roots have to dive down and go underneath. Also, one thing grass cannot tolerate is shade. It releases chemicals to suppress the growth of tree roots, because once a tree gets established, then that grass is going to get shaded out. Now, if we can keep them apart, right plant, right place, then just keep the tree and have mulch around it, and then have the grass out in the full sun where it's not going to be competing. It'd be much better.
Are we talking about trees on people's private property? Are we primarily talking about how cities and municipalities care for tree-lined streets?
Well, we're in it all together. There's ordinances now. For example, Washington, D.C. has passed an ordinance where you can't take a tree down if it's more than 17 inches in diameter, unless a certified arborist is there and deems it to present a risk or that it has a disease and it's dying. That's how important it is to maintaining the tree canopy coverage for communities.
But don't you think these builders will end up putting up always the same tree that has maximum canopy spread that grows the fastest?
Yeah, that comes back to the selection, and we have a real problem with that in the U.S. In the mid-Atlantic region of the United States, for example, we have more species of plants and animals than all of Europe, or at least we used to. When a subdivision goes in, that's dramatically reduced to, it's very predictable which plants, you know, trees and shrubs that you would see. When I walk my dog in the neighborhood, I'll see Japanese holly, spring, summer, fall, winter. It's the same bloody shrub. It's just green, usually shaped as a box or something like that.
Yeah.
And for trees, it would be the ornamental pear. In my community, you know, we've outlawed that tree now. We're not planting it on city property anymore. You are going to get those blooms, but it provides next to nothing for wildlife, and the branches are prone to breakage. And it's important to have trees in communities. Sometimes we have to back up and look at that. Why do we want to preserve tree canopy coverage? In surveys, people are always saying that they go to parks. In fact, they hold parks higher than they do like law enforcement and trash pickup. And most importantly, a study done in Oregon and Washington found that for every dollar you invest in urban forestry, you get $3.12 back in benefits. So the green infrastructure of a community can actually appreciate, assuming you get the right tree in the right place.
Joe Murray is professor of biology and a boriculture program director at Blue Ridge Community College. Coming up next, are competitions good for musicians? Our next guest says in recent years there's been a proliferation of music competitions, and while they're often beneficial, they can stifle a young musician's growth. Wayne Gallups is a professor of instrumental music education at Radford University. Wayne, competitions in music have proliferated in recent decades at the high school and college level. There are two schools of thought about whether they are damaging or whether they're toughening and helpful and a great way of sorting.
Well, I think that's true, and either could be the case. If the focus is on development of the individual as a musician and the strengths and the weaknesses and the skill sets needed to be able to compete, then this can be a very healthy event. If the focus is purely on winning or quote-unquote beating someone else, then quite an unhealthy paradigm can exist, particularly in younger musicians.
This debate is passionately ongoing.
Oh, true. Well, and it has been for generations. In Bach's day, that's how he won positions, even competing against other organists for the position. You'd come in and you'd be asked to improvise on a theme and play the instrument and sight read and perform a work. And so for musicians, competing is just an aspect of what we have to do. And ego is involved. You know, I don't know if you can get on a stage and perform and not have an ego of some sort. And one of the famous instances of that is a 19-year-old George Frederick Handel, who got in a fight with another harpsichord player, Matheson was his name, in the pit orchestra during rehearsal over who was the better harpsichord player. And Matheson took out his sword, took a swipe at Handel, and fortunately hit a few buttons and didn't kill him. We may have never had the Messiah had he done that. But we laugh about this. But as musicians, we get away from the process and into ego sometimes.
So you're not dissatisfied with the competitive environment we find ourselves in?
Well, I think if I were dissatisfied, it's because of the massive proliferation of festivals.
Is there a massive proliferation?
I think so. And if you look at what's happened even in the 20th century, you see that universities are now sponsoring many of the competitions. Symphony orchestras are sponsoring young artist competitions. And these can be great things. But if we're sending our students out continually to quote-unquote take an exam, and that's all we're about, or mostly what we're about, is preparing for the examination, then we're missing a big part of the process, because the focus becomes preparing a few pieces so you can win the competition. And when the smoke clears and all that's said and done, what does the student have? Two or three pieces.
What made you notice this? What have you done recently that has brought this to your attention?
Well, over the years as a music educator, I've had groups participate in festivals, and I've judged many marching band and concert band festivals at the university level and at public school level. I find that some music educators will respond to the constructive criticism, the focus on process, and you need to develop these skills. And some are all about, well, why did we lose? Why did we come in 2 points less than someone else? I recall a festival a few years ago, and the question from the band director was, well, why did you give us 0.2 less than another group? And my reaction was not very friendly. It was basically, okay, we just spent 15 minutes with you talking about how you can improve, and you're worried about 0.2.
We just have a moment, but I don't want to sign off with you without playing a piece on your CD, Jazzical. Tell me about the piece we're about to play, A Night in Tunisia.
Oh, well, Night in Tunisia is a standard, classic, great Dizzy Gillespie Afro-Cuban tune. So growing up in Central and South Florida, you know, that the Afro-Cuban music was just part of my surroundings and development as a musician. So I just love this cut, Night in Tunisia.
Great, I love it. Who was playing with you?
Oh, fabulous Latin percussionist Vladimir Espinosa, who's from Havana, actually, and now lives in Roanoke, Virginia. And another wonderful percussionist, Al Wotero, who plays with the Roanoke Symphony.
Well, Wayne Gallops, thank you. This has been delightful.
Thank you very much for having me, Sarah.
Wayne Gallops is a professor of instrumental music education at Radford University. His latest CD is called Jazzical. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by an anonymous donor. Support also comes from the law firm of McGuire Woods. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik, Kelly Libby, and Allison Quantz are our associate producers. Our assistant producer is Lilia Fukin. Andrew Windham is our executive producer, and Jeannie Palin handles listener services. Visit us at withgoodreasonradio.org or download the podcast on iTunes. For a free copy of the show sent to you on a CD, call 877-451-5098. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.